Welcome to the State of Women Radio Network, the first and only global radio network focused exclusively on delivering the latest trends in investing, entrepreneurship, and global women's issues by and for women and girls. Download our shows on iTunes or listen on demand right here on thestateofwomen.com. Now, stay tuned for our latest episode of Women Investing in Women and Girls with Michelle Jaffe.
Welcome to Women Investing in Women and Girls. I'm your host, Michelle Jaffe, and we are joined by Anu Bardwaj of Women Investing in Women, as well as our guest today, Hazami Barmada. And Hazami, we have the absolute pleasure to welcome you to our show. It is quite the honor, and I'd like to know from you that you do have consulting work, and you also do lots of work in societal issues and trying to bring about awareness on societal issues having to do with current racism and war and all those different topics. So just to get the discussion started, I'd like to know how your work that you're with right now with consulting and how that relates to the type of societal action that you are involved in as well.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's definitely an honor, and I applaud you on all the great work that you guys are doing. I think first and foremost, if I could just highlight the type of work I do, I think falls under the space of public affairs. And really trying to think about how do you leverage resources, institutions, governments, and people to think about constructive ways that we can work together to create a better world. And I know to a lot of people that sounds very fluffy and it sounds very kumbaya, but the approach that we take from a consulting perspective is more looking at public affairs in the sense of how can you make it a value to companies to allocate money through their CSR, their corporate social responsibility, to bringing about this type of dialogue. What is the stake of a government, for example, to engage diverse and marginalized communities within their own society from a perspective of benefit to the government, whether it's to have overt any type of revolution that may happen, whether it's to expand the amount of women, for example, included in businesses to grow your GDP as a country. So looking at it from the perspective of what works for all the different parties involved and how can you ultimately leverage those with one another to create a larger kind of conversation that has more stakeholders involved in it. I think a lot of times people look at public affairs and public relations as I mentioned, like fluff programming, but they don't see the value that comes in changing the way people as society and as citizens perceive, whether it's topics, whether it's the news that we digest, whether it's subsets of our community, including youth and women, or, for example, in the United States, an issue that's a very hot topic now is migrants and migration. Mm-hmm. So how can you think about ways to create positive conversations around these things while encouraging people to realize that it's in their interest to change the way they act and or behave to make the world a better place, ultimately.
Love it. Awesome. And we have talked to a few consultants before, and they all agree with what you just said, how the globalization of these different companies is real and it's serious. So the idea that to talk about globalization as fluff, you're right, it sometimes can sound a little bit far-fetched to have a world where all the countries can connect together, but we are going towards that goal, is trying to create those bonds between countries involved with public affairs as well. So we love your work involved with that. And your NGO that you started, Al Mubadara, you are the CEO and founder of that and bringing about Arab empowerment to America and abroad. Is that correct?
Yeah. So ultimately, the way that Al Mubadara started, Al Mubadara is an Arabic word called taking initiative. The way it started was a realization that I had through living in the United States, and I've migrated here, but people have a very narrative of what's happening in the region. People see the region through the very limited paradigms of what they see in the TV and on the news, which is oftentimes fueled by bigotry, misinformation, lack of the desire to humanize the plight of other people.
Right.
And the more I got involved in conversations with people, the more I realized that what was missing in most of our news and most of our engagements was humanity. So I started doing a lot of events in the D.C. area that really looked at how do you humanize the quote-unquote other, whomever that other is, and really looking more at how do we otherize people and what is the process that you can justify laws, for example, that marginalize women when you see them as a subset of your society or you see them as secondary or whatever else it may be. The same thing from the Muslim American perspective. I started to see that the level of racism and Islamophobia that existed was something that was really heavily ingrained in how we communicate and interact. And this idea that it is okay to lump billions of people from all types of geographic and ethnic backgrounds into one monolithic thing of violent extremists / terrorists was not only mortifying, but it was horrifying coming out of, especially a city like Washington, that is prides itself on the very core principles of what it means to be American, which is liberty, justice, democracy. So how can we take these very concepts and use them to ultimately marginalize, another subset of, a huge subset of the world? But more importantly, I was really interested in the Muslim American and Arab American community and how, looking at statistics, a lot of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans do, according to the census, make up a large majority of the professional communities in this country, in addition to the wealth communities in this country. So if you look at the Muslim American and Arab American communities, you have a heavy concentration of doctors and lawyers and engineers, and the very core people behind things like St. Jude's Research and Medical Center, which helps children across the world, was started by an Arab American. Mm-hmm. You look at a lot of the cancer research, Michael Bezeki, who developed the heart valve, is of Lebanese origin. So you're looking at all of these stories, but when you started to see media, you saw the negative side. You never see, oh, great, this heart valve was created and invented, and it saved millions of people around the world, and it was created by a Lebanese person. You only hear that the person is Lebanese if it is tied into something dangerous or violent or horrific. So with Al-Mubadara, the goal was to start creating a place where you can identify and acknowledge the professionalism and the contributions of people in the diaspora, but also then create linkages, realizing that one of the biggest downfalls in the region right now is brain drain and resources that are leaving the region, not only financial resources, but also human capacity. You have such a wealth of people in the international community that help make America, America. Mm-hmm. So why can't we engage these people and create some type of a linkage that allows people to invest not only financially, but also intellectually into developments in their home countries, which are lacking and then do need a lot of development and investment. Mm-hmm. But instead of focusing at the financial aspect, looking at focusing on the human capacity, creating mentorship platforms, creating larger conversations around what is development, looking at using technology and online tools to foster and nurture more in-depth conversations around development, and how can we better leverage the diaspora to actually be leaders of these types of initiatives.
Right. Love it. And I want to bring in a point that you mentioned earlier, is that the intolerance, the inacceptance, and the inequality that is present abroad and in America, and it almost makes it seem like America's, our foundation is almost hypocritical in the sense that we can accept many immigrants from other countries, but that we still place this stigma on such a large population of people in our country, and it's a terrible thing. And I'd also like to ask you to finish up this section. How do you see the future of the world if we perpetuate this problem of intolerance?
I think there is no future of the world with intolerance. I think the reality is geography is no longer a limit of what we can and cannot do. We were bound initially by geographic constraints. We no longer have that. When you look at the Middle East and you look at a lot of the issues that are currently happening in the Arab world and the Middle East, you cannot overlook the role that colonization played, that Orientalism has played, the fact that a lot of these countries' geographic boundaries are created often part by the French, by the Brits, by people, American policies and things along those lines. So when you're looking at the issues in the world, you have to contextualize them in not only historic things, but also looking at what role does globalization and the international community play in perpetuating, for example, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, in perpetuating the issues that are happening in Iraq, the strife that's happening currently in Syria. We obviously know that there's a lot of things that happen on the back end, including governments having roles and stakes, in addition to funders that fund political parties that help perpetuate what they want politically. And we close a blind eye to the fact that a lot of the countries that are actually encouraging this and funding and playing behind the scenes roles and pulling strings are the very countries that honor democracy in our own countries and speak to the fact that this cannot and should not happen. Yet when we do it to other people, it's okay.
Right.
So I think with globalization, you're looking at one key point here, which is the fact that the world is too interconnected. Technology has really, really, really morphed and changed the way that citizens can now access data. You now have citizens that are data or that are perpetuating and kind of citizen diplomacy and citizen journalism. So it's changed the power dynamics, which will forever change the way politics and society will work. And I think that as we move forward, if we don't look at the role that the average citizen plays, then we will continue to encounter really large instability, which is not necessarily doable. It's something that has to change.
Awesome. A great way to start off the conversation. We are going to take a break. Once again, you're listening to Women Investing in Women and Girls. Remember that we do want to hear from listeners out there. Go to facebook.com/womeninvesting or use Twitter with the hashtag womeninvest or the hashtag girlsinvest. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the State of Women Radio Network, the first and only global radio network focused exclusively on women and girls with your host, Michelle Jaffe.
Welcome back to Women Investing in Women and Girls. I am your host, Michelle Jaffe, and we are continuing our conversation with Anu Bardwaj of Women Investing in Women, as well as Hazami Barmada. And before we went to our break, we talked about the situation of Arab empowerment, both abroad and right here in the United States. And I'd love to shift the topic right now to now Arab females in the country of America and abroad, and how we're able to empower them. And Hazami, I'd like to know from you, what do you believe is the biggest challenge that females face in the Middle East right now?
I think, as an Arab female, I think that a lot of the conversations around empowerment of Arab females is something that always catches me off guard, because as someone who grew up and was raised in the Middle East and in very strong kind of Arab environments with a lot of my friends, both there and internationally, that are very strongly kind of Arab, I don't see the level of injustice that is portrayed in the media. So it never resonated with me, in the sense that all of my female friends, even in the Middle East, were lead professionals, they're lawyers, they're engineers, they're doctors. My own mother, is a geneticist and a biochemist and studied and practiced in the region. So I think, we do have a lot of barriers that we do need to overcome with equality of women, but it's not an issue that is bound to the region. And I think a big part of the work that I try to do is to show and showcase the fact that despite the challenges that women do have in different cultures, that there are huge bounds and leaps that are being made by women. And when we focus on the inadequacy and the lack of opportunity for women, what we're doing is we're not allowing ourselves to focus on the constructive and positive things that women are doing, which will inspire more women and more investors and more donors and more countries to realize that by giving more access to opportunity, by having policies that enable, for example, women's businesses, again, is in the interest of the community at large and not a women's right issue. And I think, as we approach the region and as we approach places where, sadly, oftentimes religion and culture are used, and I actually will intentionally use the word manipulated, to justify barring opportunities for women or keeping women isolated from political participation, it is those very cultures that oftentimes are historically grounded in the empowerment of women. But what happened is that we've moved away from the core cultural and the roots of culture, and we're now focusing more on the interpretation of that, which is very sadly bound to, in a lot of these countries, very few people that are dictating the agenda of the mass. On that note, I'm looking at entrepreneurship, for example. It is important to know, and I don't have the statistic offhand, but that there are more female entrepreneurs that are coming out of the Gulf than there are in Silicon Valley right here in the United States. There are a lot of examples of women that are now creating businesses that have been using technology tools to enable them to do a lot of things, including kind of having conversations online, chat groups online, and giving people outlets in places where you don't have necessarily an open platform for women to communicate. You look at Twitter, for example. Saudi is considered one of the most repressive places to be a woman. Saudi also has the deepest Twitter penetration in the world. So you're looking at the fact that we're now in a time and age where women are finding tools, they're finding resources, they're finding their voice by creating alternative platforms for themselves. And the more we're finding that women are doing that, the more they're gaining access to the public sphere by creating alternative media, creating alternative places to where now you see the faces of these women that are marginalized, and thus it becomes a tool to advocate around.
So I think that statistics, I think that came out of TechWadi. I think it's TechWadi or WAMDA, one of those two. And you touched upon a point, which is the rise of Arab women using social media. And I think what we've already witnessed in the Arab Spring already shows, you know, the power of these women's voices is already coming out in ways that were completely unexpected by the Western world. And would love to hear your thoughts on what you think the trend is going to be going forward.
I mean, I think once people find their voice, it's hard to take those words away.
Correct.
One of the things that I think we need to, as a community, do more effectively, and as a community, I say the Arab American and Arab, you know, communities, is realize that we have the tools that we need to do what we need to do. I think I keep hearing about entrepreneurship as being new to the region. Entrepreneurship has been in the region for
Silk
ages,
Road.
But
it's
doesn't have it doesn't have the term entrepreneurship. That's a very international phrase. Even philanthropy, for example, we have a culture that's heavily rooted in charity and in philanthropy, but the term philanthropy in and of itself does not actually translate into Arabic. So we're having a lot of, I think we've hit a time in history where we're having a lot of, there's a need to look inside and, you know, be introverted and say and start to question and challenge our own culture and our own perceived limitations. And I call them perceived limitations because I think a lot of them are not grounded in actuality and reality. I think part of the problem with a lot of international cultures is that we tend to, you know, it's this idea that what comes first, the culture, does culture create society or society create culture? And I think we're starting to get to a place where we're breaking out of why are cultures culture? You know, why are traditions traditions? And where are they rooted into? And we have now a very educated array of Arab Americans and of Arabs in the region themselves that are committed to exploring these very issues. And I think that's kind of, when you're looking at women's empowerment and the way forward from here, you're starting to find that there was a sense of apathy. And when we created Al-Mubadara, that was the exact conversation we had. It's people, there's a lot of apathy, and a lot of apathy because people just perceive the issues to be so grand. They just say that, you know, it's not my issue, it's not my deal, it's not my this. But what you're finding with the young professional communities is that they're starting to say, no, this is my culture, this is my society, this is my future, and I want to play an active role in shaping it. And that apathy is something that we're starting to see. It's becoming shed more and more. You have more and more NGOs that are popping up. You have institutions that are now leveraging international resources to support these types of initiatives that are happening on the ground in the region. But I think the one key thing that I do want to mention is that this is not just internationally rooted, and we give way too much credit, I think, for the international community. There's so much phenomenal work that has been happening on the ground in the region for decades that has never received international recognition.
Right.
And I think that is now increasingly changing, and I think it's more and more important to empower local communities to continue to do what they're doing and to give them the visibility to do so, because that does empower systematic change, which impacts cultural change, which is what's needed to change a lot of these policies and static ways of thinking.
Awesome. And you mentioned the apathy that is prevalent in these situations, and I'd like to know your opinion whether media has been contributing to that apathy and the lack of connection that media is taking from the entrepreneurs in the Middle East to hearing about it in America, and how we don't necessarily hear these statistics. We don't understand what's currently going on in the world, and I feel like a lot of times America claims that it's global and that we always put so much emphasis on being global, but do we really get the full picture of what's going on? And when we say that we're global, do we know that there is progress made? Are we aware of what's going on?
I think the one thing I learned about America living all over the States, when I moved here, I moved to Oregon, and then I lived in Mississippi, I lived in Boston, I've lived in Memphis. The same way that I think we have this idea of a monolithic international community, we have the same idea of a monolithic America. And what I've learned through my travels, and I jokingly used to say this all the time when I first moved to Washington and started to engage more with the U.S. State Department, is I think that we need international, the same international programs, exchange programs, we need domestic exchange programs, because some of what I heard and what I still do here coming out of Memphis and Mississippi and majority of middle America is baffling. It is baffling. People don't even know where the Middle East is on the map. Most people I met don't have passports. They don't care to travel. People in Arkansas that I met have never left Arkansas. Mm-hmm. So I think when we think about America in an international community, we think Chicago, New York, D.C., California, you know, big city.
Right.
And that is not America.
Right.
And the same, what I try to do through a lot of my engagement is to say the same way that you're seeing a very, very small perspective of what is the Middle East, I can point that same thing right back to you and ask you about the teenage pregnancy rate in the United States, and some states is worse than pregnancy rates internationally.
Right.
So why don't we talk about those things? And I think a big part of the public affairs, again, which is my background, is to be able to put things next to each other and create associations that allow people to contextualize issues and feel more empathy for them. I think with America, one of its greatest weaknesses, its greatest assets can also be its greatest weaknesses, because we do feel like we're grand, we do feel like we're superior, and we are. We absolutely are. But that should not translate into our foreign policy. That should not translate into our engagement with international communities that are struggling to develop. I was baffled when I first moved to Memphis, Tennessee, and I saw some remnants of slavery in all of the horrific things that are part of the American fabric that are still live and well when you're driving, between the drive I used to make all the time from Mississippi all the way to Memphis. You drive by rebel flags that line the highway all the way up. And, for someone who's coming from a part of the world that's struggling for justice and freedom, it makes you stop and think.
Mm-hmm.
America is so great, but we still have so many struggles. And I think to acknowledge that is where development and progress comes from, both in the United States and abroad.
Definitely. And that's a brilliant point. And we will get back to this conversation after we take our next break. Once again, you're listening to Women Investing in Women and Girls. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the State of Women Radio Network, the first and only global radio network focused exclusively on women and girls.
Welcome back to Women Investing in Women and Girls. I'm your host, Michelle Jaffe, and we are continuing our conversation with Anu Bhardwaj of Women Investing in Women, as well as our guest today, Hazami Barmada. And before we went to the break, we talked about Arab empowerment, as well as Arab female empowerment, as well as the progress that America still needs to do in bringing about tolerance and acceptance in our own country, and how maybe the progress that we've had towards equality isn't finished yet. And now I'd love to shift the topic once again to empowerment, but now taking on the view of youth empowerment and the power that the youth has in our world right now. And part of that youth empowerment has to do with something called Nexus Summits. And I know, Hazami, you're involved in Nexus Middle East, correct?
Mm-hmm. I am indeed.
And if you wouldn't mind sharing experience with those summits and the types of topics that are discussed.
Mm-hmm. I think in general, we're living in a historic time where you have 1.8 billion people around the world are young people. Never in the history of the world have we ever had so many youth inhabit the planet. And that it's not only a challenge, we hear about the challenges with regards to how many jobs can we create and the need, just in some parts of the world to create up to 60 million jobs in the next couple of years to be able to absorb the workforce that is being birthed as we speak right now. But I think on the flip side of that, looking at the opportunity that this has, when you have in majority parts of the world, you have 60% of the developing world has an age demographic of being young. So you have not only an up-and-coming huge kind of what we're calling a youth bubble that's waiting to burst, but you have so much potential and capacity in changing, the way that things happen and really shifting the status quo. One of the initiatives that I'm involved with is a organization called Nexus, and what Nexus ultimately looks to do, it's empower the next generation of wealth inheritors and wealth creators to think about ways that they can leverage private wealth and public wealth to ultimately start addressing social issues. So looking at social innovation, social entrepreneurship, and creating avenues that enable young people to be drivers of this change in a more systematic way. I think we talk about young people as being the leaders of tomorrow, but what we need to focus on is young people today and the fact that young people are leaders of today, and they need to be equipped with the tools and the resources that allow them to ultimately flourish. The joy and the beauty of entrepreneurship is young people are creating their resources. They're not waiting for people, nor are they asking permission to become leaders. They are actively engaging, connecting, and growing organically and through social media tools and through various other ways of connecting with other people. They're mobilizing. And ultimately, I think, you know, initiatives and organizations like Nexus and like, you know, an array of other ones, including Young Global Leaders and the Shapers movements and all of these different initiatives, what they're really aiming to do is to connect young people who have shared values to leverage their resources, not only, again, financial resources, but intellectual resources and in human capacity, to think about what does a good world look like? How right. can we as young people create this good world? And how can we support each other in doing so? You know, we talked about earlier the issue of globalization. I think one of the key things that we're realizing as young people is how do we leverage our own skill set and realizing that the importance of partnerships and collaborations and actually bringing about this type of change, it has to come through collaborations. We have to learn how to work in teams and across industries and across sectors, which is where sustainable development actually starts to play a role. And not looking at, for example, human trafficking as a one-off issue, not looking at women's empowerment as a one-off issue, but thinking about how do you leverage industries, communities, societies, different stakeholders to bring about this long-term change. And I think young people are seeing that. Young people see past these barriers, they see past boundaries, and they're fearless, mm-hmm. Which, you know, the whole idea of entrepreneurship is about risk-taking. And when you're able to take risks, and failure is not something you're ashamed of or afraid of, that's where true innovation starts to take place. And young people are at a place where they can do that with a lot more risk-taking, when not feeling like, you know, they have a lot to lose, because we are still young, we're agile, we challenge systems, we know the value of looking past barriers to making this stuff happen.
Definitely. And all of those goals are also part of Women Investing Women and really harnessing the power of the youth and making sure that progress is being made and using our best asset, which is the newer generation. And I'd like to know how these types of dialogues and the conversations that we're having, how is it affecting the dialogue concerning social issues? Is it changing the way that we approach these issues?
I mean, I think so. I mean, I mean, just even looking at a small-based conversation on, you know, how we're even engaging in issues in general. I mean, I think one of the key things, which is Anu and I have spoken about it even when I met her talking about women investing in women initially, was this idea that, you know, who's driving narratives? You know, and they're realizing that, you know, we now have the tools to change these narratives, thus create the future. News outlets are increasingly realizing that they are less and less and less, you know, powerful. Ultimately, citizen journalism is playing a much more active role. I mean, look at YouTube and look at these various places where, you know, people make a statement and then you have an entire backlash against these statements that are made by news anchors that people ordinarily would have looked up to. Mm-hmm. Now they're being challenged right. fully on everything that they say because right. the knowledge is at our fingertips.
Right. That's a great point. And I want to bring in that idea of technology, social media, and internet, and how they're tools for today's youth. And like you mentioned, they could be the source of negative impact and they can be the source of positive impact. So would you mind explaining your position on what those types of tools mean to our worlds and whether they're positive or negative?
I think you're absolutely right. It's very important. We look at technology as something positive. Technology is also being used to create a lot of destruction. Social media is the same thing. It's polarizing communities. It is anyone can be a quote-unquote source. You had a very, very tragic example of that is a video that obviously Syria has been in state of civil unrest, and you know, it started off as a peaceful revolution, has turned into something very deadly, which is, you know, killed about 200 plus thousand people, left half, more than half the country as refugees and internally displaced folks, with literally 1.2, one in every other person needing urgent need of humanitarian assistance. So the country is pretty much considered one of the worst situations of our time. And what you're looking at in a situation like that, you have a digital war that's currently taking place also, where different opinions and different peoples and different internal factors are now turning to digital tools to ultimately create a conversation and harness support around. So you have a very simple situation that happened last week, which was devastating, which was a Norwegian filmmaker decided that he wanted to create a hoax video of a young boy who was presumably shot by a sniper, and was running to save his sister who was hiding behind a car. And it was very, very, very well made, and it looked very realistic, and it ended up, the video went viral with, you know, 5+ million hits. It was called Boy Hero, and everyone was, like, using it to justify their side. You know, look what the Syrian regime is doing to the kids, and on the other side was, you know, look at these Syrian rebel fighters that are exploiting kids. So both sides manipulated the conversation. It turned out that the footage was fake. It was a footage that was paid for and funded by the Norwegian Film Institute that had all this type of support, and it was created as a social experiment of some sort. And the filmmaker, for the first week of this video being viral, did not think that it was fake, and so he was ultimately, I believe, pushed to by his donors, and came out and apologized for it. But what happens in situations like that is people are already doubtful of what is coming out of the country. There's a lot of donor fear around what is happening. In the international community, the media is completely dominated by this conversation of ISIS without people even knowing what is the core of ISIS, what created ISIS. The region has been struggling with fighting extremism on its own, which has received no international support and recognition up until, you know, this recent whole ISIS took over the media. So for a lot of people, it's the power of media can be both positive and destructive, but the specific instance where there's fake footage coming out and going viral with the help of social media, it's hard to justify and verify where sources are coming from, who's creating them, and that is the very thing that leads to fear. It's the very thing that leads to more and more people becoming apathetic because they're just overwhelmed with all the negativity, but they choose to block it out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, it is important to acknowledge the negative sides of things. But
definitely.
But on the flip side, I mean, one of the projects that I'm working on using social media is to rebrand that narrative, to think about how can you create outlets where you do have a positive conversation around the importance of investing into children by stripping the politics out of the conversation. So there's a campaign that I'm working on currently called Restore Happy that does that. It looks at, again, the choice of the campaign, Restore Happy. It's something positive, but it's looking at how can you kind of push through all the garbage and the jargon and the negativity and the hate and the ignorance and the lack of information to look at what is the core issue here. The core issue here is this country that's in a horrible, horrible position in a horrible state. How can you think about the future of the country has to do with empowering its young people?
Mm-hmm.
How do we push back all the negativity to realize that you, in order to build and grow and overcome this fear of ISIS and overcome extremism and all of that, you have to invest into the young people going
right,
back
definitely,
to youth.
Definitely, definitely. And that's what the
entire campaign is.
Yes, absolutely. And we will get back to this conversation once we take another break. Once again, we do want to hear from you. Go to facebook.com/womaninvesting or use Twitter, #womaninvest and #girlsinvest.
And also #restorehappy.
Yeah.
Also restore happy. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the State of Women Radio Network, the first and only global radio network focused exclusively on women and girls.
Welcome back to Women Investing in Women and Girls. I'm your host, Michelle Jaffe, and we are finishing up this conversation with Anu Bhardwaj and our guest today, Hazami Barmada. And before we went to the break, we talked about social media and technology and the internet and how it can be a positive thing and it can also be a bad thing. And it also contributes to the ignorance in America and how we don't truly know what's going on because of the influence of media and what it leaves out. And you talked a little bit about ISIS, Hazami, and how there are myths surrounding it, and how we should know the full picture of what things, what movements like ISIS are in the world, and to get the full scope of that. So do you mind explaining that a little bit further and expelling some of the myths possibly?
I mean, I think that ISIS is a horrific thing. And ISIS is something that I think the entire world and anybody with a social consciousness will think that it is horrible. I think what we're trying to do as an Arab community and a Muslim global community and as people of consciousness is to say that ISIS and the Arab world are not one of the same, that this is an enemy of all. It's an enemy of anyone with a heart and a mind and a soul, to be quite frank. And so, again, humanizing the plight of your average person who is impacted in the region. I mean, violent extremism in the Arab world has killed more Arabs and more Muslims than it has any international community. So this idea that, you know, it's a West versus, you know, this violent Muslim extremism is this very, not only hurtful, but very inaccurate reality that our media perpetuates when it creates this whole idea of othering the region. So you always hear it's like Islam versus the West. That's from a media perspective is hurtful because I am the West. Someone like me lives in the United States. I am the West. I have an American accent. I do more for this country than a lot of Americans I know do for this country. That being said, you put me in a place where I have to choose an identity based on good versus bad, which is just, it makes no sense. And that's what our media does. And I think, you know, looking at countries that are struggling with extremism, they've been struggling with them for some time. If you look at what's happening in Syria, because we focused on that example, you have situations where religious extremism is a very small part of this, of what's happening, but because of the media visibility that it's getting, it's dominating the discourse. And in doing so, you're also empowering these people that are these evil, horrible people because they're getting the media recognition that they want. So there's a lot of movements that talk about, you know, how can we humanize Muslims that are joining in this fight? But again, that's not newsworthy. And you have ample press conferences and ample events that happen. You have ample initiatives that talk to, you know, Muslims that are constantly saying, this is not in my name. This is not Islam. This is not whatever. But it does not get the visibility that these extremist movements get. And I think that's very, very damaging.
Right.
And if I could just touch on one quick thing, which is
absolutely.
In the same conversation that's happening in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, because as a Palestinian myself, I'm half Syrian, half Palestinian, you know, you hear about the rockets. When I speak to most of my American friends, all they hear about is rockets. Israel is having rockets fired at it. Again, the story that I know and that is my truth, as my family is there, is this is a very, very complex, convoluted issue. I have had many dear friends who have lost their homes in settlement expansions and in various things that are never contextualized when you talk about the current violence that is happening between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And from the perspective of, I consider myself a humanitarian. Humanitarian sees wrong and right. It should not see wrong is okay in certain situations and right is okay for certain people. Wrong is wrong and right is right. Mm-hmm. A philanthropist and a humanitarian and a person who believes in social justice should see social justice irrelevant of the aggressor or the person, you know, who is wrong. I can proudly stand up and say religious extremism, Islamic and Muslim religious extremism is wrong, and it is my moral obligation to do so. It does not take away from my faith, nor does it take away from my commitment to my own people and my identity. Similarly, I find the conversations that we have in the United States around this whole Palestinian-Israeli conflict are not only extremely watered down, but they're toxic. When you have people that justify the killing of children to say that it is okay to kill Israeli or Palestinian children in Gaza because there is a rocket being fired at Israel, and you consider yourself a humanitarian, it is wrong. Children should never pay the price of conflict. It is against every international law. It is against every religious background. And I think, you know, there needs to be more humanity behind what's happening. And the whole idea that's happening with social media, what changed with this last Gaza problem that happened, which was a catastrophe in Gaza, when you had, you know, hundreds of innocent children that were slaughtered, you had finally a lot of movement on social media that starts to stand up and talk to the humanity of these kids. You, for once, stopped talking about children as statistics and you started humanizing them, their stories, their families, their struggles, their fights for justice, their fights for freedom. And what happened is you did see a shift. Outlets that ordinarily would have never articulated the quote-unquote Palestinian side started to do so, because more and more footage of innocent lives on the Palestinian side that were being destroyed were starting to become more visible. There was that clear shift in how media was able to no longer contort a story that just justified the side of one, but you now had an entire movement, and I will say that also was supported by Israelis and by Jews in Israel and around the world to say killing of innocent children is wrong, period. Nothing can justify it. Do not say Hamas, do not say rockets, period. It is wrong. And if we can all agree on the basic core principles of humanity, then I think that's where change is going to start happening. And in that case, social media did play a very important role in helping humanize the plight of children. And I think we need more and more of these movements. We need people to realize that we have the power to advocate. And we should not only stand up for what is wrong, but we need to stand up for what is right and applaud news outlets and applaud people that stand up in the face of injustice, which is it's something that we fear. And I will say this very honestly and very openly. As a Muslim and Arab American, talking badly about what's happening in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and putting any type of blame onto the Israeli side, you get considered anti-Semitic, which is very problematic because Arabs are Semites. So, but this is this fear of, do you lose your job? Do you get plagued? Do you get put onto some watch list if you have an opinion about Israel that shows the lack of humanity around what's happening currently in the region? And that is a fear that we must overcome. It's a fear that we must overcome together. And it's a fear that we will overcome when you have more and more Israelis and more Jews that are standing up to say, violence and aggression and stealing of land is wrong. We can all agree to that. Let's then put that aside and talk about how peace can happen. But until we acknowledge the violence and the lack of humanity and the lack of ability of Palestinians to live, we cannot talk about peace. And that's the role that citizens play in helping guide and determine the outcome of that conversation.
Right. I think this was an incredibly important conversation to have, especially now when this is a transitionary period between what we knew previously and what we're finding out now with that type of media, with that type of education. So we truly, truly, truly thank you for bringing in a different side of the conversation and addressing different things that maybe haven't been addressed before. And we do want to hear from all of our listeners out there what you thought of this as well. Go to facebook.com/womeninvesting or go to Twitter and use #womeninvest and #girlsinvest. Hazami, thank you so much for being a part of our program today.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you. And thank you to all of our listeners for listening as well. You've been listening to Women Investing in Women and Girls. And the show is produced by Kidstar Radio for the Voice America Kids Network. And Kidstar Radio, we empower kids.
Thanks for listening to Women Investing in Women and Girls with Michelle Jaffe. Download our shows on iTunes or listen on demand right here on thestateofwomen.com, the first and only global radio network focused exclusively on delivering the latest trends in investing, entrepreneurship, and global women's issues by and for women and girls.